you want. You can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, well, you might find you get what you need.
Good morning and welcome to Visionaries. I'm John Lobel, your host, and you'll find us here on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. There's lots of other ways to get us. You can telephone in. You can go to the website. You'll find them all. I think we're on iTunes, podcasting, all that kind of stuff. So lots of places to find us. And you can catch my back shows at visionaries.podbean, P-O-D-B-E-A-N is Nancy.com. And today I want to talk about networking. So I do a course on creativity where I teach, and it's an art school, and their kid at Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, New York. And over the decades, I've been teaching mainly architecture students. I'm in the architecture school. But there's a new, just started this semester, interdisciplinary program in which is a series of courses, and mine is one of them, which students from all over the institute can take, actually all over except architecture. So I'm getting to meet students from other parts of the school, and we're talking about a lot of interesting ideas. The course is based on my book, Visionary Creativity, How New Worlds Are Born, which you can find on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and also CreateSpace. It's cheaper there. And we've been looking at major cultural issues, and I think we've all been following them online. I try to make a point in my the people who I follow on Twitter and the friends I generate on Facebook. I have a lot of friends, about almost 3,000, and people contact me from all over the world, you know, to what's it called? Anyway, do you want to be my friend? And I usually check that they aren't blathering a lot of political stuff. They're doing something interesting. And a lot of them are architects, because I'm an architect. And they're from all over the world. They would be cool to have an architectural contact in Dubai or Spain or wherever. So, but even so, a lot of political stuff seeps through. Somebody's angry at somebody, and somebody else is disagreeing or agreeing. So I see all that, but I try to avoid that on Twitter. You know, I'm looking for people like Ray Kurzweil and Stephen Wolfram, and, you know, there's going to be putting me in touch with radically interesting new ideas. And then I recently linked up to follow a lot of the intellectual dark web people, which is really cool. It just happened. But so I guess, you know, I am following this. What's going on? And my feeling is it's deeper than what I usually see. And I haven't read a lot of Jung, some Jung, but I'm a serious follower of Joseph Campbell. So I've recently become interested in Jordan Peterson. And if I could talk to Jordan, I've contacted him about being on the show, but, you know, me and 100 million other people, like, I don't think it's going to happen. But I'll keep trying. But in the meantime, if I could talk with him and make suggestions, I think I admire that he sees archetypal patterns underlying culture. So he gets accused of having certain political positions, and he'll object saying, I really try to avoid politics. I'm not interested in politics. I don't think politics are important. What's important is what's going on in the psychology of people, and that's where I'm trying to help people. And his insight, he's a clinical psychologist, so he's broadly aware, but his deep insight is in understanding these archetypal patterns. So he's influenced by Jung, but I think he could use some more Campbell. And I think Campbell has better insights into how archetypes work. And Campbell brings us insights into religions beyond Christianity, which I think would enrich Peterson's approach. So Campbell's very strong, mostly on Indian religions, because he edited Heinrich Zimmer's Posthuma and created it as five books on Indian mythology and art, etc. And then he participated in a book on American Indians, is very strong on American Indians, and pretty strong on Zen Buddhism, and through that on the cultures of China and Japan. So, and then also very strong on primitive mythologies, and his massive major work is the four-volume Masks of God, Primitive Mythology, Oriental Mythology, Occidental Mythology, and Creative Mythology, each 500 to 700 pages. So, you know, he's pretty grounded in this stuff. Anyway, if you're into this, his books are now showing up on audiobooks. Who can read anymore? Meyer people who do. I don't read very much. But he's also has a few lectures online. It's actually the Campbell Foundation sells audio recordings of his lectures. And there's one that it's actually online, 4 hours on the Arthurian romances. So the stories of King Arthur and Knights of the Round Table, where they come from, and their foundational role in Western culture. So I strongly recommend that. You can find it by searching YouTube. But anyway, what I wanted to talk about today was, you might recall several times I've mentioned books that are part of my intellectual foundation. And actually, if you look up Campbell, Joseph Campbell, on Wikipedia, you find quotes from him describing his long time, I don't know, several years, 5 years, 9 years, living in a cabin, no, I think it's 5 years, 9 hours a day. Look it up, get the exact numbers. Living in a cabin that he rented for $50 a year in Woodstock, before inflation, and buying books on credit during the Depression. Nobody had any money, including him. But carefully reading, you know, much of the world's literature, philosophy, etc. And he had had a background in almost completing a master's degree at Columbia and spending a year or so in studying in Europe. So he had a, you know, pretty strong conventional academic background, and then attacked the world's literature. And he goes through what he read, and I present that to my students and say, this is how you build a foundation. Now, you won't do it the way Campbell did, and it may, for you, may not even be books. But for me, it does involve books. And they include Spengler's Decline of the West, McLuhan's Understanding Media, Merleau-Ponty's books on phenomenology, Joseph Campbell's books, André Gide's The Immoralist. And what I'm thinking about today is, are books over? You know, do my students, how shall we say, create a self in the same way? Maybe I was the last, you know, of this. My family didn't get a television until I was in junior high. So I'm into TV. I put in my quite a few hours a day as I've mentioned before, I go to bed and I say, should I read this magazine or this book, or should I watch a rerun of Big Bang Theory? But I did grow up with books. I had a kind of literate family. My mother's parents live with us. So there were, and I have a sister, so there were six of us in the household. And my grandfather, my mother's father, was a mystery story writer. So he was always clicking away at the typewriter. And although he had sort of stopped publishing in the 30s or 40s, he was working on a big novel, which I should publish someday now that Amazon's Create Space makes that doable. But I, in my book on creativity, I look at how the creativity is embedded in its culture, the culture of its time. And is our culture still books, or has it become something else? So I write a book, a real book, not a contrived book for people to buy as a holiday gift. Can take years to write. Books represent a way of knowing and existing. A person with a point of view is interested in something and wishes to understand it more deeply. From their point of view, they research it, think about it, and come to conclusions. Then they present their findings in a book, a medium that communicates with other persons, other individual persons, who invest their time in reading it, following the arguments, perhaps disputing them. But all this is dependent on the existence of literate individual persons capable of knowledge, insights, and emotions with points of view. Marshall McLuhan, who I've spoke about quite often on this show, describes the printed book as a source of individualism, of a private and fixed point of view. So we might describe that as literacy. And so I write, as literacy is replaced by, I make up a word, electronicy, individual, person, and point of view, as we have known them, are replaced by something new. So those attached to literacy, and so I begin this chapter of the book with some quotes from things that run across in the newspaper. An article in the New York Times titled, Growing Up Digital, Wired for Distraction. Matt Rochelle writes about 17-year-old Vishal, V-I-S-H-A-L, who was assigned by his school to read Kurt Vonnegut's Cat's Cradle over the summer. Distracted by making videos to post on YouTube and hanging out on Facebook, he only makes it partway into the book. Then another one, 14-year-old Allison Miller, Rochelle continues, provides Vishal with serious competition, sending 27,000 text messages per month. So what's with this generation? Then I write, we could lament the activities of Vishal and Allison. Just as Socrates lamented what he saw as a destructive effects of reading on the Athens youth of his day, who, he said, would lose the ability to memorize. And we could celebrate the entry of Vishal and Allison into new worlds of interactive discourse and visual thinking based on their immersion in video making, a kind of thinking those from a literate past may never fully experience. So, yeah, my students, you know, can make videos. It's just something you do. It's a way you communicate, something you make and post. And people my generation, although my younger colleagues, even if they're older than my students, probably can do that because starting, you know, a few years ago, architects became quite immersed in digital capabilities. Anyway, so we can ask, are books over? And so what would be the alternative? And I'm suggesting it's how we're networked. So one of the things I do in my book, Visionary Creativity, is look at how what's going on in the culture, in science, in technology is not, oh, a function of material evolutionary progress, you know, that the horse begets the wagon begets the wheel and axle begets the train begets the automobile, and pretty soon the automobile beget the self-driving Uber, you know. But rather, all of which is probably true. And if you're a reader of, if you follow technology, hopefully you've read some Lewis Mumford. Although maybe he's pretty dated today, but he's pretty good on a lot of the scholarly information. And if you want to skip Mumford, start with McLuhan. I think he'll get us there quicker. But anyway, from this point of view, these cultures come about out of a, these technologies come about out of a culture. So actually, let's credit Lewis Mumford, who says, man has to become clock before he can make clock. So the mechanical clock comes about in Europe around 1000 AD. And, you know, there are all kinds of clocks, water clocks, sundials, stuff like that earlier. But our mechanical clock that we still, it's interesting looking at watches. Just for the hoot of it, I get this magazine, The Robb Report. And it's all about private jets, yachts, and watches, and custom-made expensive sports cars for the super rich. Although I don't know how many of the people who read it are super rich and how many are people like me. When I first subscribed to it, they called me up and asked me how much money I had. And I should have told them, you know, a lot, because that would have gotten me invited to wine tastings and openings. And, you know, I told them the truth, which was, you know, did not get me invited to wine tastings and yacht unveilings, et cetera. So I made a mistake there. But anyway, actually, I should resubscribe under a new name, see if I get another chance. But anyway, you see how, if you go to a website, wish.com, it's a Chinese company that it lists, they don't, as near as I could tell, they don't sell anything. They list vendors who do sell things. And unlike eBay, they're all at a fixed price, so there's no bidding. But, you know, watches are $2. A $2 watch and another dollar for shipping can look pretty decent. I get addicted. I've got a couple dozen of them. I keep buying them. Well, what's $3? But they keep totally accurate time, you know, probably accurate with, I don't know, what, 2 seconds in a year or something like that. Remember my grandmother got me a watch when I was a kid. And I was always opening the back, pushing this little thing, you know, for faster or slower to try to adjust it so it would tell accurate time. Always, you know, once every 2 weeks, you had to reset it, put it forward or back 2 minutes. Today, they're totally accurate, you know, for $2. Well, in the meantime, people are buying mechanical watches for $10,000, $20,000, $50,000. You know, I'm thinking of, you know, obviously electric cars are going to happen in every way. They're incredibly superior. They develop full horsepower and torque at any RPM, so you don't need a gearbox. You don't need a clutch. It's, you know, starts from a dead stop at full power. It's got, what, one moving part compared to a couple hundred in an internal combustion engine. And so if carefully made and maintained, it should never wear out. Although mechanical motors do pretty well, it's probably the last thing to go in your car. Although my Ford Taurus blew a gasket. That was annoying. I brought it in. They said, that shouldn't have happened. These engines are usually pretty good. But, you know, the problem is the battery. But once that happens, I can see people buying 12-cylinder internal combustion sports cars just for the mechanical beauty of it, which is why they buy these mechanical watches. But anyway, so Lewis Mumford said, man has to become clock before he makes clock, and by which he meant he was focusing on the importance of monasteries in the West. So remember that book, How the Irish Saved Civilization or something like that, and it, about how with the fall of the Roman Empire and the loss of everything, all the technology, they didn't know how to, you know, make a plow or a horse harness or writing or, you know, how to feed themselves. And all that gets lost, and some of it is preserved in the monasteries, including in Ireland. So the author admits the title's an exaggeration, but it does make a point that with civilization, writing, literacy preserved in the monasteries, and these monasteries being very strict on, you know, waking up at 5 o'clock, meditate for an hour, go for breakfast for an hour, pray for an hour, that kind of thing. They were very driven by the clock, and somebody's keeping time and ringing the bells, you know, to direct all this. Well, after a couple hundred years of this, they, you know, got stuck in their mind and maybe they should make a mechanical clock. So that's what my book is about, how these creative inventions, these technologies, arts, literatures, are embedded in and grow out of and lead their cultures. Well, anyway, what's our culture doing today? And I think it's networked. We have become fractally networked computational nodes. And so what do we see in technology? We see Facebook and social networking and now blockchain, Bitcoin and blockchain. And blockchain is linking all these computers. I have a section in my book where I explain, I hope I got it right, BitTorrent. So BitTorrent is one of those sites from which you download pirated movies. And I get up in the morning. There's no TV, and I can't get on the internet on my computer, you know. No, actually, the TV was there, but my computer wouldn't go on the internet. I just got, call this number. Your internet provider has detected that you have downloaded a pirated movie. This is your second notice. Four more and we cut off your service for life. So, long story that I won't go into, because I think there's some unacceptable activity here. But so I call them up and tell them, yeah, I gave my password to the people down the hall. They have these teenage kids. They say, yeah, well, you know, change your password and we'll turn it back on. But you have to listen to this message first. Anyway, so we're all networked. And you don't realize what it means if you get cut off from your networks. Like, I mean, if I deleted my Facebook, yeah, I understand you can't, but if I deleted my Facebook account tomorrow and never looked at Facebook again, I wouldn't miss a thing. Nobody I know, no circle I'm in communicates through Facebook, but my school communicates with me through email. You know, I have to go online to get my course roster. They don't give me any paper. I go to my mailbox, you know, twice a semester. Actually, I better go check it. I haven't been there in a while. And so if I can't get online, I can't get my course roster. I can't submit my grades. I can't function. So maybe we don't realize how dependent we are on this stuff, even if we don't like it. I mean, I might say, I don't like this. Put a printout in my mailbox. I'll fill it in and I'll give it to the office with my grades. And they would probably do that. I mean, you know, the people in the office are supportive of me. And they probably say, fine, you know, give me, you know, I'll log into the administrative account and record your grades for you. But, which is what they used to do before we all got networked. Anyway, so think of Facebook and then think of 2 billion, is it, members. And even if half of them are fake, you know, spewing out political propaganda, there's still a billion. That's a lot. And then think of all those who are friends, if that's the right word, or following, and draw a line between them. You're going to have a pretty dense mess of lines. And then on top of that, take a person posts a post or a picture, and then people click on that they like it. So all these likes. So now you have all these, draw a line between everybody who likes something and what they like. You're going to have a lot of lines. As a matter of fact, your paper, piece of paper drawing these lines on, is just going to be solid black. Assuming you could get a billion dots on a piece of paper. Now, realize that computer scientists have to deal with this. And the way they do is they put it in higher dimensions so that they can have a million-dimensional space in which they're putting these dots. So they might have one dimension for all the members, another dimension for all the likes, and another dimension for all the posts. And now they can link them in hyperlink them, right? Remember that term? In all these dimensions. I remember I was the first person in my school to get a Mac. And so I could tell right away I wasn't relating too well to computers. You know, I took an adult ed course at my school because it was free in Windows. So what? No, I'm sorry, it wasn't Windows, it was DOS. Windows isn't so bad. I mean, the first Windows 1 and Windows 2 didn't work. Windows 3 sort of worked. And today, I still hate Windows. I get really annoyed when I have to go to the podium at school to lecture. And, you know, I put in my flash drive to put my lecture on for the projection in the auditorium. And then it, you know, it's like, why doesn't it show up as a graphic image? I can just grab the file and drag it over like I do on a Mac. You know, there's all this weird stuff. And actually, years ago, school gave me a computer for a year, and I was just battling Windows all the time. I hated it. And I know, I have Windows colleagues who prefer, you know, they have trouble with Mac and prefer Windows. So it's a matter of what you're used to. Well, I'm used to Mac. What can I say? Anyway, so I notice how you can click on things. And somebody, and I really got into this. I had a low number. Like I was number 27 in the New York Mac users group, NYMUG. And so that was pretty prestigious. I guess it doesn't exist anymore. But you really had to be a member of a users group to get information. There were a couple of Mac newsletters. I subscribed to them. They came in the mail. Paper newsletters about the Mac. There wasn't an online world yet. And so then everybody joined AOL because that's what there was. There wasn't, you know, email was, you were a member of AOL or Genie or what were the others? But General Electric had one, and there were several of these. And AOL quickly became the biggest, so you joined AOL. And then you could email anybody who was on AOL. And because it was all internal to AOL, there was this cool thing where you could delete an email. So you send somebody an email and say, oh, my God, I shouldn't have sent that. If they haven't opened it yet, you can go and delete it, which, of course, you can't do anymore because as soon as you send an email, it's left your server and it's on their server, so it's out of reach. But anyway, I go to the Mac World, which was at the Javits Center. No, it was in Boston. I went up to Boston to go to Mac World. I mean, I was into this. And was I just there for the day? Did I stay in a hotel? I'm trying to remember. But anyway, they were in Boston and New York before they, you know, then they just settled on San Francisco. And I find out about this software, which is graphical. You can make whatever you have in databases. And you make a field, and you can make it activated. When you click on it, it goes to somewhere else, which is, you know, hyperlink, which is this new thing, one of the things that launched with the Mac. And I said, oh, my God, I could make an architectural textbook this way. You'd have, say, you know, Ionic columns, and then there's text, and then you, and it has a volute, and you click on the word volute, and you get this Nautilus shell spiral, and then you click on that, and you can navigate through it. And I'm trying to get support for this, you know, that, and of course my school is nowhere with this stuff, but, you know, I could have pioneered the interactive CD. This is long before Microsoft brought out Encarta. And it's interesting how Microsoft did that. I think they weren't that interested in publishing an encyclopedia. They're just trying to show what Hyperlink could do. And I remember they had conferences on CD-ROMs, what they were, how to use them, how to make them. And my Mac didn't have a CD-ROM, so I had to go out to school and a CD-ROM player. But anyway, so I think we're not even aware of how linked we are in this network situation. And it's even to the point that it, you know, it bugs me where, so early on I got iTunes, I got a iPod to play music. So I get this thing. I can't turn it on. I bring it to school, hand it to a kid in the front row. He says, how do I turn this on? He says, well, first you have to unlock it. Little button on top. You move it over so it's not showing red, you know. And I said, well, where's all my stuff? He says, well, you got to swipe it over. You know, it's in the next screen. Oh, you know, had this little wheel. You move your finger around. It was really cool. So I put my music on there. So you go to iTunes, you buy a song for 99 cents, you download it to your computer, then you plug in your iPod, and it move it over to the iPod. Cool. Now I can listen to it walking around with headphones and in the car. And I was used to this. I mean, I'd been walking around for years with a, pardon the, it was embarrassing, with a fanny pack. you think of, pardon my sexism, overweight women tourists in spandex, you know, in the hot weather in Greece or whatever, with fanny packs, with their, you know, their purse and their passport and all that. And so I walked around with a fanny pack with a Walkman in it, and a half a dozen cassettes all jammed in there. Because maybe I'm listening to three books at a time. You know, I want to say, okay, that's enough of that one. I want to switch over. And I need two cassettes for each book because if I finish the cassette, I want to go on to the next one. And I get home and I have to restock them. So I was into this earphone world. But the iPod was a big improvement, and I kept it for a long time. It's so tiny. I think the size of, what, two sticks of gum? And there's one I got where the thing had a video camera in it. The stupid thing the size of two sticks of gum can hold like 1,000 songs. And, you know, recorded books. I put my books on there, so I didn't need to walk around with cassettes anymore. And it could make videos. Oh, and you could download a movie. I downloaded the Matt Damon genius movie, Good Will Hunting. Cool movie. So it was one of my favorite movies. And I said, you know, the screen is what, a half an inch by an inch and a half? That's pretty small for watching movies. But, and you could record video. I mean, it's just, but anyway, eventually I gave up, you know, and I just have them on my phone. Because it, oh, the problem was, and I love these little things, and it doesn't use up my phone battery. Its battery lasts a long time on the iPod. But the battery goes. You know, the battery doesn't hold a charge after a while. And it's $45 for the kit to install a new battery. I brought it to everybody's Mac, favorite Mac service place, TechServe. On 23rd Street in New York, where, you know, that's where you brought your Mac to be repaired before there were Mac stores and Genius Bars. So, and they were really great people. You really appreciated them. All my old Macs I would give them, you know, for parts or whatever. I had a screen. I had a little bit of money once, and okay, I'm getting a new Mac, $7,000, $3,500 for the screen. It was a 32-inch high-def screen, the absolute best thing you could get at that time. I said, the screens, that's where the rubber meets the road. Your eye's not on the processor. Your eyes are on the screen. Let's get a good screen. And I got a, and then fortunately, it became possible to upgrade the USB to USB 2. And then, you know, I got rid of it long. But then the screen died, and the Mac was, of course, worthless because there were much better Macs. But anyway, back to this networking thing. I go to download a book from Audible or a song from iTunes. So iTunes says, you can't download this song that I just bought. You already have it in the cloud. So I don't want it in the cloud. I want it on my phone so I can hear it in the basement. Well, it is, you can't. You're networked. Well, not only that, now I go to buy an audio book. I click, I bought the book. I said, well, where do I download it? You know, how do I get it on my phone? I call them, it's already on your phone. When you buy the book, it downloads to your phone automatically. Well, that's cool. But, you know, so this networking thing, again, I think we don't realize how much we're tied into this. I said, okay, I just want to see how this works. I pay $15 a month for the iTunes family plan. That means every piece of music ever created is available for free anywhere, anytime on my phone, on my laptop, or on my wife's computer. I think up to five people or something like that. So I'm driving in the car, and we're listening to an autobiography, my wife and I, of Debbie Reynolds, because we've been listening to the autobiographies of her daughter, Princess Leia. What's her name? Forgetting her name. The actress who just died, who is Princess Leia. And so, you know, let's listen to a Debbie Reynolds autobiography. So we listen to that, and her first husband was Eddie Fisher. And my wife says, what did Eddie Fisher sound like? I said, wait a minute, pull over. And I'm pulling up an Eddie Fisher song just like that for free on my phone. Play it through the car radio. So as Luddite as I am, as book person as I am, I'm more networked than I like to think I am. But then what I'm proposing is that this becomes our culture. So I've mentioned before Lynn Margulies, who died a few years ago. She's an evolutionary biologist and bacteriologist. And she proposes that evolution is driven not by natural Darwinian natural selection. She and her son, whose father is Carl Sagan, wrote that life did not take over the planet through warfare, but by networking. That everything is linked and that bacteria and virus move around entire genomes so that, you know, we've got cat DNA in us. How we get that? Well, at some point a while back, some cat's, you know, virus picked up cat DNA, infected a human being, and moved over cat DNA into humans. So there's this, everything is like networked. It's all tied together. That's just, you know, one minor little example. Her point is the whole thing works that way. Every time you sneeze, you know, what is it? We have 2 pounds of bacteria in our bodies. We have more, 10 times more bacteria DNA than human DNA in our bodies. And every time we sneeze, we're blowing it all around, exchanging it, interchange. I was just on an airplane. God knows what was going on. Bacteria were having a party. And hopefully my face mask helped. My wife's an opera singer, so I have to wear a face mask on an airplane. So here's science thinking networkingly, Bell's theorem, entanglement, quantum entanglement, that everything is entangled with everything else. Every subatomic particle on my fingernail, you know, is somehow tied into what's going on Alpha Centauri and everywhere else. So science and technology are thinking this way, and we are this way. Well, it's not all good. One of the things that Marsha McLuhan pointed out, the textbook for understanding of all this remains Marsha McLuhan's Understanding Media, written in 1964, 30 years before it happened, but he got it all right. And he became lionized as an advocate for electronic technology, which at that time was TV. And he wrote a lot about the computer, but we didn't have computers. They had computers. But he saw them coming. I don't think he really latched on to how quickly they're going to miniaturize, because Moore's Law is also 1964, same year he wrote the book. So it's only a few years later that people figured it out. So you look at Steve Jobs designing the first Macintosh. He had already done the Lisa, which was just like the Macintosh, only a lot more capable, but a lot more expensive. So the Macintosh was sort of the affordable Lisa. But when he did it, it had 128K of memory, whatever that is. My phone has, what, 64 gig? So whatever that is. But gazillions of time more. But the thing was, how could he, I mean, what are people going to do with this thing? It's black and white. It's 72 dots per inch. The printer is printing 72 dots per inch. So it can make all these typefaces, but they're really clunky. Well, a couple of years later, he came out with the laser printer, 300 DPI, looking beautiful. And now they're 600 and you can't see the dots. But he knew that the reason I only had 128K was that's all, you know, memory was so expensive. But he knew that it was going to double every 2 years in affordability. And sure enough, it quickly went to 512 and then 1 meg. And now today, you know, 64 gig. 128, I guess, if you buy, if you're buying top of the line. So anyway, we're in this networked world of expanding capability. Oh, I know where I was. So McLuhan, you know, would confess, he said, I'm not advocating this stuff. I'm just describing it. He was a James Joyce scholar. You know, he was into books. And people accused him of, well, you're attacking literacy in books in, you know, advocating for the new electronic age, but you wrote a book. Well, what was he supposed to do? Make a YouTube video? 30 years before that was going to happen. But the book is written in a very disjointed way, very much like a quick edited movie. The movie A Hard Day's Night, done by Richard Lester. And he had pioneered that quick edit jump cutting technique in a little video called the Running, Jumping, Standing Still movie. So I'm sure it's on, I haven't looked it up, but I bet it's on YouTube. So look it up. And then watch A Hard Day's Night, the way it jump cuts. And that's the way McLuhan wrote, you know, in a sort of literary version of this. But now we read that. Let me look at my notes here. Here we go. So this is the most exaggerated version of it. I'm afraid it's going to happen here. China blacklists millions of people from booking flights as social credit system introduced. Millions of Chinese nationals have been blocked from booking flights or trains as Beijing seeks to implement its controversial social credit system, which allows the government to closely monitor and judge each of its 1.3 billion citizens based on their behavior and activity. Hello? 1984. And, well, you know, East Germany just got over that, the Stasi. They did the whole thing without computers. They had 3x5 card files on every single person in the country. Half the population was spies, spying on each other and the other half. And, you know, the worst thing that happens in the with the collapse of East Germany is the files revealed, you know, all these people you thought your friends were reporting on you, which, no, not because they were evil, because somebody had reported them and they had something on them. So as we see that happening in our culture, we look at the government hearings now about Facebook, and I'm reminded of the movie The Man Who Fell to Earth, 1976, starring David Bowie. Beautiful, surrealistic movie. So it's about a space alien who looks just like us, except for his eyes, comes to Earth, and he wants to build a great space vehicles that can bring water from Earth to his planet that's suffering from drought. That sounds improbable, but that's the plot. So how's he going to do it? Well, he has to create immense wealth. Well, he's in touch with all this technology because he's from an advanced civilization. So he hooks up with a patent attorney. And he starts making these fundamental patents and building this immense industry that's, you know, bringing about all this advanced stuff and making hundreds of billions of dollars with which he's going to use to build his technology to get water to his home planet. Well, the government takes it away. You know, they capture him, kill his associates, and take it over. How long does Zuckerberg think this technology has, which can influence billions of people? How long do you think it's going to stay in private hands? And which was the most recent Bourne movie, right? What is it, Bourne Supremacy or whatever the last one was, in which there's a guy who's created a fictitious equivalent to Facebook, and it's got a back door for the CIA, and he's about to reveal it, so they have to assassinate him, and on and on and on. So you think that isn't happening? You think intelligence doesn't have a back door to everything on Facebook and Twitter, et cetera? And is anybody going to object? We're in this world now of groupthink. Everybody goes along with it. Maybe I'll talk more about that next week, because I'm running out of time. But when I was a kid growing up on Long Island in a very progressive community, and I listened to, you know, the outlets into an alternative world, the alt world of its day, where on the radio, Gene Shepherd, who would talk about all this cool stuff. And maybe Jazzbo, the DJ who would play jazz, and then the Village Voice, which I subscribed to, and then I.F. Stone's Newsweekly. So I.F. Stone had been a straight establishment reporter, and he dropped out from the establishment to tell the truth. He'd actually sit in on and read the minutes of congressional committee hearings and, you know, all this underground information that's now everywhere. I mean, everybody wants to be the next Woodward and Bernstein, and we're knee-deep in conspiracy theories and alternative news and everything. But I.F. Stone was it. Later, Krasner's The Realist. So I was immersed in all those worlds, knew some of those people eventually, but and was aware of it as a counterweight to the straight Eisenhower establishment, straight-laced world of the establishment. You know, there were only three networks. TV was Ozzie and Harriet, or I Love Lucy. And then there were these people called beatniks who lived in Greenwich Village. There were these people on the road who would travel between Cambridge, San Francisco, and the Village, and that sort of triangle. And then I got one of them as a roommate when I was in college, and he'd be on the phone with somebody from that on-the-road world, and they would ask him, so how's the beat scene in Philadelphia, where I went to school, University of Pennsylvania? He would say, oh, he's okay, meaning me. I was it. I was the only person, 20,000 people at the University of Pennsylvania, and I was the only one with a beard. I mean, jeez. And I was even told I wouldn't be allowed into graduate school unless I got rid of it, which made me more defiant than ever, but I eventually got rid of it just because I got tired of it. But anyway, so I've been following this, what's going on at a college called Evergreen. And go look them up on YouTube. They're pretty well covered. And what happened was, without going into the story, maybe I'll talk about it next week, is that they were doing something in their conformist leftist politics, and some reasonable leftists objected to some aspects of it, and immediately his life is threatened. He's surrounded by people screaming at him. He has to conform or, you know, leave. No discussion. The whole true believer groupthink behavior. So having grown up in a world of true believers and groupthink, I looked them up on Wikipedia. I just ordered I have it somewhere in my book storage, but I ordered Eric Hoffer's The True Believer. So Eric Hoffer's this really cool guy. He's a longshoreman and philosopher. Very prominent in the 50s and early 60s, often on talk on TV shows. But so I'll talk about his book. I'll talk about groupthink and true believers. But the best description of it is a book by Lee Smolin called The Trouble with Physics. And so he describes what groupthink behavior is, and I'll talk about that next week. So listen, let's sign off. This is John Lobel. You've been listening to Visionaries on PRN.FM. Be sure to download our app for iPhone and Android, and you'll find us here next week at PRN.FM. And catch this show and all our other back shows at visionaries.podbean.com. See you next week.